And people would come and say, my God, what an ego this guy's got. He's got his own picture on his Fuji table. But really what it was a chance for me to practice opening my heart to myself and to appreciate the predicament I'm in. I mean, I could see the whole incarnation. If I'm quiet enough, I can see his storyline. I mean, history is his story, or herstory, you know, and herstory is just the storyline of our predicament. And it's a finding a place in yourself from which you see the unfolding of law, that dad did this, mother did this, economics did this, education did this, opportunity did this, drugs did this, Maharaji did this. All of this, cause and effect, previous incarnations, all of it is just an unfolding of a storyline, a drama, the Ramdas story. There he is. How will it come out? How did it come out? And you're just sort of watching this story unfold. It has nothing to do with me, because I'm not that. That's just a set of phenomena happening. And when you look at yourself as a set of phenomena, what is to judge? I mean, it's no, is that flower less than that? It's just different than that. And you begin to appreciate your uniqueness without it being better or worse. It's just different. And cultivating an appreciation of uniqueness rather than preference is a very good one. And it's just when you get inside identification with your personality that you get into the judging mode, because then you are part of that lawful unfolding. You're not stepping outside of it at all. The witness or the spacious awareness is outside of it. It's another contextual framework. Yeah. As you're more quiet inside, so that you notice and you can see your own thoughts a little more clearly, you will see your father's voice and your mother's voice and all your education principles' voices inside your head, constantly saying things to you. And you will see that, I mean, what Freud calls the superego, you will see that that judge is inside, that, and you keep giving it power by identifying with it. And you feel yourself at war with yourself, that there's a part of you that's doing it and then there's a part of you that's judging what you're doing. And as you're quieter, you see the dynamics between the superego, the id, the ego, and you see it all as just phenomena, because they are phenomena. I mean, as a psychologist, I can study those phenomena in another person. Why not study it in myself? And part of what drugs did for me, and then meditation did for me, and all the spiritual things, is it helps me stand back and get outside of it to see it for what it is, as just a stuff, phenomena. Phenomena. Questions? Yes.
Ramdas.
Yes.
How can we love ourselves more? Please.
Instead of the term, how can we love ourselves more, I'd like to ask, how can we accept ourselves more? That in the way most of us have been socialized, the way in which a child gets, learns, the initial learning, is that the parent is under pressure to socialize the child, to make the child socially functional. And in doing that, they emotionally, whether they intend to or not, reward and punish the child for behaviors. And the result is that when that starts very early, before there is a lot of reasoning process between the parent and the child develops certain emotional feelings that certain ways it is in its natural state are not acceptable. And the result is some feelings of unworthiness or inadequacy or something in most human beings as the result of socialization. Very few people ever come through socialization unscathed in some way or other. I mean, that's not an unfair statement, I don't think. So in a way, you could see that ego or personality is in a way built upon, and that's where Freud understood it. He saw that the repression of id or impulse life, because of the way the society has to deal with a child's impulses to get it to be socialized, usually is left with a feeling that somehow I'm bad. I have these things that are not acceptable. And so then you build this social structure, and often what you end up with is a personality that says, that's constantly looking to the world and other people, do you approve of me? Do you like me? Am I good enough? Am I acceptable to you? And have I achieved enough? And you get an A for effort, and you feel good. And if you don't get the A, it's not like you feel nothing, you feel bad. And it's as if the baseline is negative, not zero. Do you hear the issue that I'm talking about? Now, so that you're constantly using your life experiences as a way to disprove a basic negative feeling about yourself. That's a very, very common thing in social structure and in human development, in ego development. Now, many psychological systems, like Freud's system, for example, works primarily with negative going to zero. That's the domain that you work with. Right behind that is where the spiritual dimension begins, and that's a part that looks at the universe and just sees it as it is. It doesn't see when you've got a negative thing, the opposite, when you're trying to undo it, you could undo it by emphasizing the positive. Like if you don't like yourself, you could emphasize, I love myself, which is how do we love ourselves more is the question. Or we could say, let's go behind love and hate and find a place where we merely acknowledge ourselves, where we just allow our humanity. And we hear that there is negativity in us, and there is inadequacy, and we allow ourselves. And the word that I have come up with, I mean, that I'm finding most comfortable to work with, is the word appreciation. That we come to just appreciate what is. It's interesting, the way I've looked at it, is that you go out into the woods and into the forests, and you look at trees, and you appreciate the trees. You don't say, that tree is good and that tree is bad because one tree is fat and one is thin, or one is tall and one is short, or one is bent and one is straight, unless you're in the lumber business. For the most part, you just look at the trees and you appreciate them the way they are. They are what they are, and you can appreciate them. But the minute you get near humans, it's interesting that you immediately go into a judging mode. You come into better and worse. And you do that out of your own insecurity. You do that out of your own need constantly to be reassuring yourself. So you're saying that person is got more hair than I do. Or that person is see, that's the one I picked. So I wonder why. That or you go into you find dimensions constantly judging and equating, am I as good as, am I equal to, am I as good a mother, am I as beautiful a woman, am I as effective a worker, am I, whatever it is, whatever dimension. And you get caught in constantly living in a judging realm. And if you start to practice seeing people as trees, I don't mean in the you know, in the sense of just appreciating what they are, including yourself, it's just starting to appreciate yourself, appreciate your humanity. Like when I get, like I'm supposed to be, I'm Ram Dass, and I've worked on myself, and I'm supposed to be equanimous, loving, present, clear, compassionate, accepting. Oftentimes, I get tired, I'm angry, I'm petulant, I'm closed down. Now, for a long time, I get into those states, and I would feel really embarrassed because that isn't who Ram Dass is supposed to be. So I would appear like I was warm, charming, equanimous, compassionate, and there was deviousness and deception involved. And then I realized that that's bad business because that cuts us off from each other. And I had to risk my truth. I had to risk being human with other people. And realize that what we offer each other is our truth. And our truth includes all of our stuff. And the first thing I had to do was accept my own truth. I had to allow myself to be a human being.
And I think that I was very helped by my spook friend, Emmanuel, who my disembodied friend, who, when I said to him, Emmanuel, what am I doing on Earth? He said, why don't you try, you're in, on Earth, why don't you try taking the curriculum? Why don't you try being human? And I had always assumed the way to God was to deny your humanity and embrace your divinity. And then I realized that the way to truth might be through acknowledging the fullness of where I found myself to be, which was my humanity and my divinity. And not wallow in it, but acknowledge it. And not reverence it or judge it. Just appreciate it. Just allow it. Allow my humanity. So I have gotten to the point now where I am what I am much more, and some people like it and some people don't like it. And if they like it, that's their problem. And if they don't like it, that's their problem. I don't take it all on myself and as much. And, well, it's a slow process. It's a slow process. Now, what I found was that as I started to allow myself to be human more, just allowed what I am, things changed much faster in me. I mean, things fell away more quickly. It was as if I was locked into a model which was based on that negativity, that dislike of myself. And once I just allowed that I am human with all the foibles, things started to flow and I could feel change occurring in myself. And then I would start to experience my own beauty. And it frightened me because it was so dissonant and discrepant from the model that I had cultivated of myself over the years, that I had to do good in order to be beautiful. And the idea that I just am, that what is, when you look at a tree or a rock or a river, it is in its own way beautiful. You look at decay, it is beautiful. I know Laura Huxley, who's a very dear friend, in her kitchen, she has these jars over the sink, and she takes old beet greens and orange peels and things and sticks them in water in these long, beautiful pharmaceutical jars. And then they slowly mold and decay, and there are these beautiful decay formations and mold. And it's really garbage. It's garbage as art. And we look at it, and it's absolutely beautiful. There's absolute beauty in that. And I've begun to expand my awareness to be able to look at the universe as it is and see what is called the horrible beauty of it. The horrible beauty of it. There's horror and beauty in all of it because there's decay in all of it. I mean, we're all decaying. I mean, I look at my hand and it's decaying. And it's beautiful and horrible at the same moment. And I just live with that. And with that, I start to see the beauty in it. So we're talking about appreciating what is. Not loving yourself as opposed to not liking yourself, but allowing yourself. And as you allow, it changes. That's about, I think that gets behind the polarities. I think that's what's important. Okay? Question?
I've been aware myself.
There's such good questions, this group, we've all come up with. Go ahead.
That every time I've been able to let go of some fear, it's been in the presence of love. And I don't know whether that is me reorganizing my ego structure and whether I have to give up my attachment to feeling safe enough to let go of my fear. Is that just a readjustment? Or so is the thing that I'm calling love or feeling as love, love, and what's the relationship between love and fear?
I think that the term love, which has in it two uses of the term. One is as the polarity between love and hate, and that has in it being loving as opposed to hating. And the other is a quality or state of being in which the term love is used in the same way as presence or awareness is, that we enter into love, into the space of love. And I think that love lies behind fear. I think that when you are experiencing fear, you are caught in your separateness. When you are experiencing love, you are caught in your unity.
with all things. That love is, the verb love is a vehicle of permeating the boundaries, and when you experience that opening of the boundaries, you feel the quality of love, which means a flow or energy or merging with the universe around you. And that one is obviously the antidote for fear. It's going to the place behind your own separateness. And the romantic quality of love, which is between separate entities, is a doorway into the deeper love. It itself is, a lot of people experience a quality they call love, but they're doing it with their mind. They're not really opening their hearts fully. They are loving, meaning I am attracted to or I am attached to. But it isn't the quality of this kind of liquid merging. And I think the quality of love you are talking about, when Emmanuel talks about love versus fear, for example, we are talking about being versus fear, or unity versus separateness would be the other way of saying it. So I would say that when the fear dissipates, you are feeling at home in the universe, meaning your identity with your separateness isn't so overriding your feeling of connection with everything that you're feeling cut off and vulnerable, which is where the root of the fear is. So as you cultivate that unitive quality, then the fear dissipates. So the relation is one between love and fear, but it's not the love in the sense of I love you. It's the sense of we are together in the space of love. Yes.
This is another question about love and opening to love. And in your stories, the ones that always touch me the most and the ones I tell other people are the ones about you being opened by Maharaji, and my favorite one is about the orange and the foot. And when I hear these stories, I open too, and I love that feeling. And the question is, how does that feeling of opening to love, where does it connect with an idea of God?
If you keep seeing, I'm just giving you this now, a way of seeing the sequence. If you see the new baby open, permeable boundaries, all completely wide open, and then you see the cultivation of its mind and models of itself and other, and development of a sense of separateness, and then you see the way in which we get trapped in that ego or sense of separateness and get trapped with identification with body and with personality, our phenomenal self. And then the question is, how do you awaken out of the illusion that you are only separate? And the doorway out of that is through the heart, because the heart is, my heart goes out to you. The heart is the doorway into the unitive nature of the universe. And it's the love flows. Love doesn't know boundaries. The mind creates boundaries. The mind creates the boundary of separate me and you. The heart just keeps embracing and opening out. So that things that open your heart open you out into the universe and allow you to experience the preciousness, the grace, the sweetness, the thick isness of it all, the interconnectedness of it all. It's even more than interconnected. It's all one thing and just keeps changing its flow and patterns, and you're just part of it. And the opening of the heart is the doorway into that. So that when you love your pussycat, or you love your child, or you love your beloved, or you love nature, or you love something, that is a doorway. You start with that kind of love, which is relational, romantic love, and then that's a doorway that moves you into the kind of merging quality
where we are together in love, which is in the in the oneness of it all, in the existence of it all, which is God. That's the way in which you experience God. You experience, you are part of the divine manifestation into form, and you're one with it. So you start with this very relational love that is between you and something else. And it opens the heart, and then you, in a way, go out through the heart and keep feeling a connection. Because you know when you're in love how suddenly other things look beautiful other than the beloved. It keeps going out and out and out and out. And that's a quality that... So I would say that most of us stay locked in our separateness, and we are very frightened of coming out of it. We feel very vulnerable. In truth, you are not vulnerable at all. You just think you're vulnerable. Who you think you are is vulnerable. Who you are is not vulnerable. It's true. This is the truth of it. That's what Christ was saying over and over again, but nobody seemed to want to hear him. But you are not vulnerable, but you experience you are. And so it's very hard for you to open your heart to another being whose love is conditional. Because they're saying, I will love you as long as you're a certain way. And that you keep protecting yourself. So you find yourself very easy to open yourself sometimes to inanimate objects or to an animal or to a memory or to a very young child that's very innocent. Before it develops any kind of definition of itself that starts to manipulate the universe to get what it needs. Well, when you're with a guru, the guru realizes they're not vulnerable. They don't need you to do anything. They don't even need you to not shoot them in the shooting example before. They just need you to be what you are. So their love is unconditional. And when you're in the presence of unconditional love, that's the optimum environment for your heart to open because you feel safe. Because you realize nobody wants anything from you. And the minute that heart opens, you're once again letting in the flow, and that flow is where you experience God. Is that dealing with the question? Yes. Next.
I always felt God was love. Love was God. Then I got a Zen therapist. And he...
Did you help him?
Now I'm kind of floating somewhere over the idea of love's part of a duality and that it goes. And the second part of this is, what do you take with you when you go? Is there any sort of information about when you drop your body, what goes with you?
Those are two different questions, completely different questions. It's not a second part. Those are two different questions. And the second, that question, I'm sorry, goes in another group about illness and dying, so you can't have that. You can only have the first question about Zen and love. When I first started to do Vipassana meditation in 1970, I would go and sit with Goenka and Manindra and people like that. I'd sit for 30, 40 days and three or four courses. And I'd come out of it so dry, my heart would be so closed, that I just want a bhakti hit. I just want to go to a I want to go to a devotional place and just sing to God. And what I've noticed over the years is, and I noticed it most recently when I was sitting with my Burmese teacher these 3 weeks, that by the end of the sitting, in which all I was doing was watching the muscle rising and falling in my abdomen and lifting, moving, placing, the end of 3 weeks, I felt closer to Maharaji in love than I had ever felt before. But it wasn't romantic love or I love you. It was a quality that what the emptiness of Zen, it means empty of the clinging to forms. It doesn't mean empty in the sense of nothing. It means
And it has a quality in which it said it is neither, I mean, it's neither empty nor full, as one of the says. There's an experience of intense presence when you get quiet enough. That quality of presence is exactly the same, finally, as the quality of love. It's a quality in which it's expansive, so everything is included, and yet nothing is standing out or grabbing. But it's all present, and you feel emerging, and you feel an at-homeness, and a warmth, and a being with. And that is as much the result. When I'm with a Zen master that is a real mensch, you know, a real evolved Zen master, I feel the quality of our joy of being together in our appreciation of nothing, of empty, of the void, if you will. And it's not a feeling, it's not an intellectual appreciation. It's appreciation from inside it. It's as if, and I feel that it's interesting because next week Zalman will be here. Zalman Schachter, who's a very dear friend, and he's a rabbi, and he's in the tradition of excess emotion. I mean, like, you know, it's all kind of slurpy romanticism. I mean, he's also way beyond that, but he is also out of that tradition. And I can be with him, and I can look in his eyes, and we meet in a place that is so clear and so true and so present, that love so transcends the romantic, melodramatic love that is part of that vehicle. Just as when I meet the Zen master, we meet in that same place with our eyes and our heart, even though his path is a path of asceticism and of denial, of not dealing with the emotional stuff at all. So I keep reminding you that the paths up the mountain look different, but at the top of the mountain, the stuff comes together. And that emptiness and presence and truth and beauty and heart all are right there. And you can feel the fullness and the richness without the emotional drama. So it's the term love again that's where the sticking block is. And love is like a red flag to a Zenny, you know, just like emptiness is to a bhakti. What do you mean it's all empty? You know. Okay.
About this time last year, I think it was, I had what I thought was a really important insight, and it probably was, which was that I'd spent a lot of time thinking that my natural habitat was unhappiness, that was the natural colour of things. So I decided to go for happiness, and I spent time kind of recognising happiness and embracing it and so on. But thinking about desire systems, it occurred to me that perhaps the desire for happiness is something that I have to let go as well. So, some practical advice, please.
I had an interesting time with that because there is in Buddhism, one of the things is, may all beings be happy. And in the metta meditation we were doing, it's, may we be enabled to carry out our lives in peace and happiness. And as long as I kept happiness as the polar opposite of sadness, it was like keeping love as the polar opposite of hate. And then it turns out there's a semantic issue of which level you're using the word at. And to the extent that happiness means being in harmony with what is, meaning being peacefully in relationship to everything that is. Finally, I realized that my happiness isn't based on the situation being this way or that way. My happiness is one which embraces my sadness. Finally, my love is one which embraces my own hate. And that quality of happiness from just being in relationship to the universe as it is, not because it's this way or because it's that way, is this deeper quality of happiness that is what this Buddhist prayer is asking for. So I think what you were doing was playing with the polarity of happiness and sadness. Now you understand finally that the way you look at your sadness is not as something to push away, but something to, yes, there is sadness in life. And my sadness came out of my truth also. See, I mean, when you've come up for air out of a lot of sadness, you want to cling to your happiness. But as long as you're clinging to anything and pushing anything away, you're vulnerable. It's got you. You're always frightened because you're always waiting for the slip and you'll be cast back into sadness. And finally, you have to embrace it into yourself, all of it. So I'd say now that you have learned to be happy, you can turn around and look back at your sadness and start to allow that that's a part of you too, until you've embraced all of it into yourself. Is that... Any more? Just want to read you... this is Emmanuel's new book. And I'm just going to read you a few pages. I just wrote a preface for this book, and the preface was called Uncle Emmanuel. And it referred to the fact that I think of Emmanuel as a kind of a nice uncle. I don't think of him as an enlightened being. I think of Emmanuel, those of you that have never heard of Emmanuel, Emmanuel is a spirit entity, I think they're called, who is channeled, I think is the word, through a woman named Pat Rodegast. As I say, I don't find Emmanuel's... But there are many planes of reality other than the physical plane, and there are beings that live on those somebody planes, and they have their work to do too. But his stuff is quite beautiful, and it's been very helpful. To me, that's the final criterion. Does it help me? If it doesn't help me, might be fine. It's just not relevant to me. I've learned to say about spiritual teachers, not that they are wrong, but that I have no business with them. I have no business with Rajneesh. Now, I have no idea who Rajneesh is. Who he is his karma. All I know is when I go near that, I feel, I don't have any business there. Right? And that's what I've learned to do, which is leaves me free of having to judge everybody all the time. But that person is wanting. It's just that I don't have business with them. So these are just a few little images from Emmanuel that are kind of sweet. What does the voice of fear whisper to you? Fear speaks to you in logic and reason. It assumes the language of love itself. Fear tells you, I want to make you safe. Love says, you are safe. Fear says, give me symbols. Give me frozen images. Give me something I can rely on. Loving truth says, only give me this moment. Fear would walk you on a narrow path, promising to take you where you want to go. Love says, open your arms and fly with me. Every moment of your life you are offered the opportunity to choose, love or fear, to tread the earth or to soar the heavens. Why would fear want to oppose truth? Because truth has the power to transform fear. Fear believes it is fighting for its life. I want to say something about the subtle inroads fear can make in your lives. If you no longer allow fear to step blatantly before you and shout of cataclysm, it will creep behind you and whisper something reasonable in your ear. Beware of reasonable, rational thinking, reasonable supposition. Doubt is the rabbit's foot of fear. Ask your higher wisdom if it is not true that without worry you would have arrived exactly where you are now
and more pleasantly. Worry and fear are not tickets on the express train. They are extra baggage. You were going that way anyway. Emmanuel, how can I remain loving when there is so much danger in the world? You are afraid that justice and love are not all they ought to be. You are afraid that if you were to stand open in love, you would receive violence, mockery, humiliation, and destruction. There are those of you who declare the world is real, an eye for an eye. Rules give an illusion of safety. Structure comforts fear. Fear says, put me in a house with a roof and locks on my door, and I will believe I am safe for a moment. When you are loving, you are under the open sky, and possibilities are infinite. Contrary to Chicken Little's expectation, the sky doesn't hurt. There are no guarantees from the viewpoint of fear, none are strong enough. From the viewpoint of love, none are necessary. I don't really think he answers the question. Okay. Well, that's his problem. I'll just read a couple more. I feel my fear has a life of its own. I can't control it or transform it. Perhaps fear needs to be played out. Does this make any sense? Only to fear. See, yeah, I got to work this out. It lives on the belief that you grant it. There is never a circumstance where fear is not a choice. See, for me, maybe the way I've been dealing with choice, you see that whether you choose fear or love is a karmic matter, but you still have the illusion that you're making a choice, so make it. My fear of death is overwhelming. It seems so final, Emmanuel. Death is the greatest gift that your schoolroom offers you. You can assume a bravado and say, of course I have chosen love, and beneath that verbalized choice, fear can still be in control. But when one actually moves to dying, fear can no longer hide. Your fear at this moment is your greatest teacher. When you have heaped all your fears into this one undeniable area of human experience, you will have formulated the arena in which you can work. Address dying, fear, where it cannot escape you. It cannot subtly move away and pretend to be something else. This may not bring you comfort, but bringing you comfort is not my purpose. My purpose is to bring truth. When, without even knowing the meaning of it, you say with every inhalation, I choose love here, I choose love, you will see the light change and the darkness dispel. Your mind may say, I don't understand what happened. All I did was sit here for 15 minutes choosing love. Well, that's all that's required. The lifeline, the golden rope, is to know that there is such a thing as love, and in that moment you are empowered to choose it. Just that. Even if your heart is breaking and you feel on the edge of collapse, say, I choose love. By this mantra, you silence the lifelong mantra that would choose fear. Then this last one. If fear seems to follow me, what do I do? Hold fear in one hand, hold love in the other. Holding both, choose love, and choose love again. Fear may call you back, what about me? You answer, yes, fear, I hear you. I choose love. You may be part of human conditioning, but love will always be my choice, for that is the only reality. Fear will shout, but I am truth, listen to me. You reply, my choice lies outside of illusion, not within it. Then watch the pyrotechnics of fear. It will tell you that the plane will crash, the food is poisoned, you will be left alone forever. If you enter into any of these scenarios, you are caught. Fear is only a teacher on your planet. Your schoolroom is always held within the hand of perfect love. All the monsters to be created on your planet have already been unleashed, so fear will have no new faces.
Oh, perhaps a virus or two. Nothing more. Fear has emptied out its bag of tricks. Nuclear destruction, genocide, cancer, AIDS, torture. And still, there is the human heart that seeks to see love. That is the voice of transformation. That is the voice of truth. Fear is the frightened child. Love is the flame of holy remembering. This morning, at around 7, I went over to the office to call my answering machine to get my messages. And there is a woman that is very emotionally, she's very emotionally unstable. And she had filled most of my answering machine with dozens of messages. And she was calling me during the night, and every time the machine would cut off, she'd dial again and call, and she had used, you know. So I had to listen to hear if there are any other messages to hear, listen to her. And it was interesting, because she was very paranoid about the CIA, about people poisoning her, about the woman down the street who had turned her into the police, about the police, and they're all these fucking bastards, and she was carrying on. And then every now and then she'd say, Ramdas, I love you so much. And when she'd say, I love you, the whole tone of her voice and the quality of her being would lift. And then a moment later you'd feel the mind grab hold again, and she'd go, and those bastards, and she'd go back in. And since I didn't have to react, I could just listen to these rhythms and her voice. And her way, she came out and went back in, and came out and went back in. And the fact that she calls is because she's reaching out for that love. That she knows that, because when I talk to her, I just, all the paranoia just goes through just like that. And I keep saying, you know, don't feed it, Jhana. Here we are in love. What are you feeding all that for? You know, do you really want to fill your mind with all that crap? You know, here we are. And slowly she, oh, Ramdas. Oh, it's great. Thank you. Okay, Ram. It's as much as I can talk to you today. Fine. Bye. And then a while later, she'll start again. We've been going on for now 9 years. And she was the first about 20 minutes of the messages. Then there were a few other messages in there. And then of, hi, Ramdas, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then there was a guy who I've been working with for probably, oh, he's probably almost as long as her, maybe 8 years or so. He's a carpenter in New Hampshire. He called up and said, just want you to know I'm really angry at you. You see, you keep making believe you're my friend, but I don't know that you're really my friend. And he was just like, rawr. And he called about, oh, 7 times to... See, when I went, I put the message, since I knew they'd do this, I put it on 1 minute, so at every minute it cuts off, so they gotta keep calling. I figured I'm gonna make them pay for it if they're gonna cop my consciousness, you know? And he was so angry, and I thought, well, if you're this angry, why are you calling me? You know, I mean, I don't know if I want to be your friend anymore. Well, don't. I mean, it's okay with me. And it's, these are forms of love. I mean, and you can hear that in the middle of all the anger, in the middle of the paranoia, is this incredible space of love that exists between us. And I feel I'm going to grow old and die with these people. They're always going to be around, and we all know each other, and that's just the degree that they can handle that amount of love. And their poor minds, the poor worlds they live in. You know, and you can't... She goes in and out of mental hospitals, and he has too, and they can't drug them out of it, and they can't, you know. In the old days.